history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who have some ridiculously exciting and entertaining stories to share if we take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And we're going to hear another one today. In fact, if you caught our last program, you heard a veteran by the name of Cal Erickson tell his story, but say, hey, my story's nothing. You ought to hear from my brother. Well, today we hear from one of his brothers, Grant Erickson, 94 years old, of Santa Cruz, California, and the 10th out of 11 children growing up. So by the time you came along, I guess your folks must have had it figured out. I mean, they must have had a well-oiled machine going there.
I think they must have had, yes.
And did your older siblings pick on you? Did they whip you into shape? What was
that
like?
Not really. No, you know, life was, I think it was terrific. I think I fought more with my younger brother, though. The two of us pretty scrapped quite a bit.
He was the one that you could push around a little?
Yeah, that's right.
And you grew up in Central California?
Yes, Delray, on a farm. We were growing mostly grapes and alfalfa, things like that, tree fruit.
Did you have to work on the farm?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had to stack trays when the rain came, you know, when we had the grapes and making raisins.
So you had to get the raisins out of the rain or else they'd get moldy.
That's right.
It's funny how that's still the way it works. All these years later, the technology really hasn't changed all that much.
I think that's probably right.
Was that pretty hard work? I mean, is that how you remember
it? Oh, it wasn't too bad. No, I kind of enjoyed it, actually.
When you think back to those days, I know that's a long time ago. We're talking more than 80 years ago if we go really back to your childhood. Do you remember having any dreams or ambitions or the thoughts of what I'm going to do someday when I get off this farm?
From an early age, I thought I'd like to be a teacher someday. Mm-hmm. All of my brothers were farmers, mostly, so I decided, well, I'd kind of like to fall in line with the girls.
Was that it? You wanted to meet the girls? You figured there's a lot of females teaching?
Well, that was part of it. Yeah, I graduated from Sanger High School. You probably know all about Sanger.
The Apaches.
Yes,
sure.
The Apaches, that's right. Went to Fresno State. Eventually, when I was home on leave from the ship in 1944, I married my wife. We hadn't had a date until we were seniors in college, actually. I think I was kind of a slow learner.
Because you'd known her your whole life.
I'd gone to elementary school with her, high school, and so forth.
Right.
Same church youth group. Yep.
How about that? Well, I want to trace some of these steps. So you graduate from Sanger High School. You go to Fresno State.
Yes.
Which then was just a teacher's college.
That's right.
There wasn't a lot more going on. Now it's a huge ag school, has so many different programs and all the big sports programs.
Right.
Although there were some pretty good sports teams then. I mean, they had a pretty good football club, didn't they?
That's right.
Well, I imagine you were at Fresno State when Pearl Harbor happened.
That's right.
What do you remember about that day, December 7th?
Well, I remember that it kind of just, I was stunned. It was almost unbelievable, really.
You would end up one of five brothers who served in the war.
Right.
Were any of them in the service yet when that happened?
One of my brothers, Lambert, was the first one of us to go into the service, and he became a field artillery officer serving in the South Pacific, mostly in the Philippine area. My brother, Ralph, went in next. But I think he went in 1942 and served aboard the USS Washington, which is a beautiful battleship. Mm-hmm. Actually, in comparing his battleship to mine, the New Mexico, I loved my duty, but it wasn't quite as safe as being on the Washington because they had better 5-inch .38 guns as opposed to 5-inch .25 on our ship. which were not as good as the others.
Your ship was a little more seasoned.
That's right.
Had a little more history behind
it. Yeah, that's right.
When did you get this idea, though, about the Navy? Because it sounds like your idea was, I'll finish up school at Fresno State and get my degree before anything happens with the military.
Well, when I went into the service, I thought I would like to go into the Navy, but I thought that I would like to finish my degree first. So I signed up for the officer's training program that allowed me to get my degree at Fresno State in 1943. And I got it 6 weeks before the end of school because Northwestern University had a new class starting and they needed 4 or 5 new additional officers to complete the class. And so I got my degree and my credentials a little bit early. Didn't have to take my final exams, which was great.
Yeah, that's the way to do
it. I wasn't too good in trigonometry.
So it worked out exactly how you wanted it to.
Right.
Until you got to midshipman school at Northwestern.
At Northwestern. I tell you, we got back there to Chicago. We stayed at Evanston, Illinois. It was assigned to the 14th floor, as I recall, in a big bunk room with 15 others. We had 8 double bunk beds. I hardly made it through the Navy that first night. Actually, the first thing we did when we got there was to take the obstacle course, and that was something that I hadn't been used to. It. We had to run through it not only once but twice, and I was dead to the world, you might say, when I went to sleep that night. And I had a little, one of those guys that would talk in my sleep a little bit. And so right in the middle of the night, I yelled, fire!
Uh-oh.
And everybody jumped out of their bunks except me. They said, I said, well, why doesn't somebody turn off the water or something like that? Well, they could have killed me. So you see what I mean? But anyway, that was the first day in the Navy.
I guess so. So you you end up commissioned at a rather young age. And I've heard a lot of people talk over the years about the 90-day wonders. And you were one of those.
I was one of those. That's right. Pearl Harbor happened, and we had to get a lot more people qualified quickly. So I became a 90-day wonder. And, of course, I learned a lot of things at Northwestern, seamanship, gunnery, and all of that. That was a part of the curriculum that I hadn't ever had much to do with, you know, at Fresno State. But it was great. I didn't mind it a bit.
And before you got to your ship, the New Mexico, which you have quite an encyclopedic knowledge of now and have quite a history with, you did some training on the battleship New York?
The battleship New York in Norfolk, Virginia. The New York is equipped with 12 14-inch guns, big guns. I had 6 weeks of training in, of course, the projectiles and the powder to blow them was so heavy that they had to use a hoist to load the guns, you know.
Yeah.
And so had went through all of that operation, and I was hoping that I wouldn't have gunnery duty.
You didn't want any part of that.
Didn't want any part of that.
And that's how it worked out for you when you got aboard the New Mexico, and that was October of 43. And little did you know what you would see and experience on that ship. But it's pretty unique for a young man your age to have the kind of duties that you had and the interactions that you had with the top officers on that ship.
Yeah.
A pretty historic ship.
Yes.
What was it like for you when you first went aboard the Queen, as they called her?
The Queen. It was very pleasant. The fellows were all great. And we had a bunch of wonderful officers. I mean, there was a lot of camaraderie, you know. It was great. I had the feeling that, well, here we go. We're heading for Pearl Harbor. And the captain gave a wonderful speech and told us that we'd soon be in the thick of things, you know. Kind of gave us a little bit of an idea of what to expect. Our main job as a ship was to cover the landing of our troops, Army troops. And the idea in any battle, in any situation like that, was that our newer ships would go in ahead of time and do the damage, kind of clear it for the troops, you know.
The bombardment.
Yeah, that's right, for the bombardment. And then they would leave, and then we would take over and cover the landings and, you know, fire our 14-inch guns. Our first operation was in the Gilberts at Macon Island. I think the most the biggest eye-opener, you might say, at Macon Island. We were there to cover a landing, and we were anchored off of the island. And about 6 o'clock one morning, it was a tremendous blast. It was dark out, and I ran up topside, and all I could see off of our starboard bow, about 1,000 yards off, was the complete outline of a ship, which was in total flames. It turned out that the Liscombe Bay, which had been a cruiser reconverted into a carrier, had been struck by torpedoes, Japanese torpedoes. There were, I think, 52 officers and 591 enlisted men who went down to their graves that morning along with the ship. Didn't last very long. Aboard our ship were even certain body parts and things like that. It was just, you know, it was, that was the beginning of the war as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, that is quite a welcome to the war.
Real eye-opener.
How did you digest that? How did you process that?
Well, I sort of took the attitude that I was there to do a job, you know what I mean? And it, not all in a day's work, but, you know, had a job to do. And I think my training through the year as I grew to manhood, you might say, I think my faith took me through, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I've always been connected with a church, and I think the spiritual education that I received as a youngster and on through the years helped me a lot. I think it caused me to face anything that came along.
Well, maybe we can explore that later when we hear some of the things that did come along, because they're pretty significant. I know we're bouncing around a little bit, but you mentioned your captain.
Yes.
And you have a great photo album here that we were just looking at. There's some photos of that captain, and you've also written down some of the things you remember him saying. And I got the sense that his speech when you went aboard the New Mexico, and you'd end up working fairly closely with him.
Yes.
But that his speech really had an impact on you.
It did.
What was the biggest impact of that, or the thing that he said that really stuck with you or really kind of crystallized your focus?
I think it was that we were all in this together. And if we all did our job that we were assigned to do, that we would make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I had the feeling that he really knew what he was doing, too. I felt safe.
Well, he sounds like a fascinating character, Captain Zacharias.
Yeah.
From what I read here that you shared, he'd been in Japan,
In Japan in intelligence, in that right. He was fluent in Japanese.
He'd been in World War One, and in the intermittent time,
that's right.
He'd done naval intelligence in Japan, very familiar with the buildup, spoke fluent Japanese, and toward the end of the war was quite involved in trying to convince the Japanese to surrender to save lives.
Exactly. Leaflets were even dropped over Japan, you know, that he constructed, you know what I mean, and telling them that you're losing the war, you might as well throw in the towel, so to speak, you know.
And I imagine your exposure to that probably gave you perspective that a lot of guys didn't have. I mean, there's 16 million Americans in World War II, and a lot of them really had a hatred for the Japanese after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
I'm sure you felt some of those emotions too, but being around that captain who seemed to have that big picture in mind and seemed to have compassion and want to bring this to a close.
Right.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how did that kind of shape the way you viewed everything that was going on?
I guess it caused me to do the best job that I could do in my specific job. One of my jobs was to train lookouts in the identification of aircraft, both enemy and ours too, aircraft and ships. The captain really gave you that inspiration to do the best you could. I know at one time, one of our captains, we were involved in an air attack and general quarters was sounded. And I know that there was one young enlisted man going up to his battle station, which was in forward aft. He was almost to the ladder. He started to go up and started to come down. He was just really kind of psychologically messed up. The captain happened to be there and he put his hand on the boy's shoulder and he said, "What's the matter, son? Are you scared?" He said, "I sure am." And the captain said, "Well, so am I. And don't let anybody tell you I'm not."
Wow.
I mean, that, you know, coming from the captain of the ship was, you know, very meaningful.
I could see that. I wonder how many captains would have the humility and transparency to say that.
Yeah, that's right.
You made reference to some of your duties on the ship. What were some of the other things you were responsible for?
Most of my watches were spent 4 hours on, you know, and then off and so forth in the CIC, which is Combat Information Center, where the radars who do all the plotting and so forth and so on. And then I stood watches on the navigation bridge. Because I did, I think I had the opportunity to know the captains more intimately, perhaps, than many of the people aboard the ship, you know, could, especially during general quarters when we were under attack. It had to be at our battle station, and my battle station was the navigation bridge. I was close to the operation and could see what the captain was doing. And, of course, the captain lives on the bridge. Has his own little compartment there. I think I was blessed to have such wonderful captains. They were all just terrific.
So you mentioned when the Liscombe Bay gets blown to bits, really. Yes. I mean, to the point that some of it was coming onto your ship. You witnessed that devastation. Did that send a message to you? I mean, did you receive a message there that, hey, this very same thing could happen to me? This really is dangerous?
I didn't think of that often, really. I guess I sort of thought, well, if something happens, it happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. And maybe before we get into some more of the specifics and the close calls you had, maybe you can put your ship in perspective for us, because you talked about that this is a battleship. You talked about the role of it. But what about the size and the scope of it? I imagine coming from a small farm town in Central California, this is a pretty eye-opening experience to be on this giant battleship with all this firepower.
Yeah, it was. Actually, it was just short of 2 football fields in length.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty big. Of course, the nice thing about being on a battleship in rough weather, the listing is not that much as it is if you're on a destroyer, for example.
Sure.
You just go almost tip over, you know. And the width of, actually, when we came back after the war, went through the Panama Canal, mm-hmm, and decommissioned in Boston, I think we cleared the Panama Canal, but see, it's 6 inches because that we were that wide.
Yeah. Scraping the sides, huh?
Yeah, right.
Well, we haven't even scratched the surface of Grant Erickson's Navy experiences during World War II. When we come back, we'll hear how he survived a kamikaze attack on the USS New Mexico in January 1945. Head to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and videos of Grant. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 94-year-old Grant Erickson of Santa Cruz, California. If you missed his brother Cal's story last time, you can pull up that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. Cal was a B-26 pilot and the youngest of 11 children. Grant was 1 spot ahead at number 10, In all, there were five Erickson brothers serving in World War II. We'll get back to Grant's story now and life aboard the battleship USS New Mexico.
We had a daily newspaper, which had sort of the plan of the day. Even in enemy territory, we'd have like Sunday services on the, you know, and we look forward to that. You know, they had Catholic services and Protestant services and so forth. And there were times when we could hang out on the quarterdeck, you know, and sun. You know, I don't know which operation it was, but we had a couple of Australian vessels that were with us. And I know even when we were in enemy territory, they were having their tea parties on their quarterdeck. And I know in one occasion, I think it was in Okinawa later on in the war.
Yeah.
One of them was hit. They had to interrupt their tea party several times.
Quit the tea party. There's a war going on.
Right.
Well, and I think this is a pretty unique or at least intriguing part of your story. You go through all this action in the Gilberts and the Marianas. Then you get a 30-day leave. So you say, okay, why don't I get married?
Yeah.
How did that come about? I mean, how does a kid who's an officer on this battleship in the Pacific who knows there's still a lot of fighting still to come home for a month and get married?
Well, I had been engaged before I went in to the service. I was going to be on leave for 30 days, so I thought, well, why not? So we were married in Kingsburg, actually. Neither my wife nor I had ever been to that church, but most of my relatives were in and around Kingsburg, so I guess we figured that that would be a pretty good place to get married.
Uh-huh. Did you have to twist her arm at all?
No, not really. No.
You'd waited long enough to ask her out from knowing her whole life till you were a senior in college for your first day.
Right.
But and I've talked to a lot of veterans about this. Some have said, hey, I wanted to make sure that I got engaged before I left so she didn't end up with someone else while I was gone. Other guys say, well, I didn't want to ask her because I wasn't sure I was coming back.
Yeah.
Obviously, you made the decision to get married knowing you're going to have to go back out to sea. Was there any thought in your mind that you might be leaving her a widow?
No, I didn't have any thought of that at all. I've always been optimistic, positive person.
Does that come back to your faith again?
I think it does.
It might happen to somebody else, but it wasn't going to happen to you?
Yeah.
What was that like, though? Because, I mean, here you've been out there at sea, and I'm sure you had a lot of thoughts on your mind. You've got four other brothers who are in this war. You got your mom back home praying for you every day. But now you go back out to the Navy, and now there's a wife that you need to make sure you come back to.
Yeah, she probably thought about it more than I had thought about it. I just didn't think I thought I'd make it.
Well, you were right.
Yep.
But if they had told you what you were going to go through, I don't know if you would have had the same assessment. Did you get a little honeymoon before you went back on the ship?
Yes. We took off, stopped in Bakersfield first night, and
Everyone's honeymoon destination, Bakersfield, California.
Bakersfield, California.
Where they're listening to us today on KNZR. So no offense, Bakersfield. It is a great honeymoon destination.
Yeah,
at least it was for you. Sorry to interrupt.
But no, we went a little further the next day. We went down and stayed at the Biltmore Hotel, checked in there. Had a good surprise there because when we checked out, the clerk discounted my bill by 50% because I was in the service and thanked me for my service.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very nice.
Absolutely. What was it like, though, to have to say goodbye to her?
Well, that was kind of tough. But I thought, well, it's going to be okay.
Did you carry a picture with you or anything?
Oh, yeah, had a picture.
Where'd you put it?
I kept it in my wallet.
Yeah, and then it's back to the ship.
And my wife went back to teaching at Cambria Pines.
Uh-huh.
That was what she was doing while I was in the service.
On the Central California coast there. And, well, I guess that's pretty close to the same ocean that you were off there sailing in, just many, many miles away.
Right.
And some of the worst things were yet to come for you and for your ship, the New Mexico. So what happened next?
At Bremerton, we took on a new captain, Captain Fleming. No more Zacharias. He was now gone. We stayed in contact with him, however. But Captain Fleming was a wonderful, wonderful fellow, kind of soft-spoken guy, and gave this nice talk as we left Bremerton and said that we'll soon be in the thick of battle again, which we were. And so it wasn't too long before we were out there in suicide country.
Well, and that's my question. So all this time you've been out there, had you ever heard of this phenomenon of a plane
really.
That would try to crash into your ship?
Not really, no.
So when you get back out there, and now the first weeks of 1945, you got your first taste of this kamikaze thing.
Yeah, that's right.
And you saw it happen to other ships before your own?
Oh, yeah. Actually, in the Philippines, we were supposed to cover for a landing on Luzon, which is on the eastern area of Philippines. We were supposed to send many, many, many projectiles, you know what I mean? But we couldn't because we were too involved in fighting the aircraft. I think it was the California was hit by a suicide plane before our ship. Actually, every major ship on that day that we were hit was hit at least once by a suicide plane. And the problem was that our aircraft covering couldn't really take off from Tinian because it had been raining so bad. The weather was terrible. And so we had no air cover. So we just had to fight it on our own.
So you're up there on the bridge?
I'm on the bridge.
And what can you see?
Well, I see planes.
Planes everywhere.
Planes kind of everywhere, yeah. And we shot at a lot of them, too, you know what I mean?
But they're all Japanese.
Yeah, right.
So the only defense you have is the guns on these ships.
Yeah.
So but a couple days before you get hit, an escort carrier near you, the Omani Bay, gets hit.
Yeah, right.
And you guys took on those survivors.
Took on the survivors, yeah, right.
So it's kind of building toward, this is happening to everybody else.
Yeah.
When's it going to happen to us?
Yeah.
It was a couple days later that it did.
Yeah, right.
So what happened at noon on January 6th of
45? Well, a plane came in from up above, and it had been hit, but it was coming, so it had to land somewhere.
Yeah.
It was a Zeke, a Zero, I think, called. And carrying a 500-pound bomb, and it landed on the port wing of the navigation bridge.
And that's where you were?
That's where I was. I was just inside of the bridge.
Yep.
And the captain was standing at the entrance to the bridge on that port side looking outward, and he was blown to the bulkhead inside of the bridge in kind of a seated position against the wall, the bulkhead, we call it the wall. I remember quite vividly how it was. There was a young seaman who was also blown toward him, right next to the captain. And I recall the captain putting his arm, the boy tried to get up, and the captain putting his arm on the shoulder of the boy, and he said, very weakly said, "Son, stay right where you are." And I recall that those were his last words. Medics came up right away, and they gave him a shot, but he was gone. I knew he was gone. The officer of the deck under whom I was serving, Lieutenant Sobel, was not injured that badly. He took shrapnel in his ankle and maybe a few other places, but he was injured, I've always felt, more psychologically than any other way. He went down to sick bay. He was taken down to sick bay, I guess, with some others. In addition to the captain who was killed, we lost a gunnery officer, and William Chickering, who was a Time War correspondent, was killed. An officer of the British Navy and one from the British Army who observation guys that were aboard our ship, they were killed. It was just pandemonium. It was pretty tough. And steering, there are about four or five places on the battleship from which it can be steered. So the helmsman was injured on the bridge. So steering control was taken over down in the conning tower, which was below the bridge, and the navigator of the ship took over the control of the ship temporarily until everything could be worked out on the bridge. And eventually, the executive officer came up to the bridge and was now the new captain. He was a commander, but he was elevated to the rank of captain almost immediately.
Sure.
And became the new captain.
And you became the new officer of the deck.
And I became the new officer of the deck. It's kind of interesting because you have to serve your duty as a junior officer of the deck for 8 months, I think, prior to being elevated. But anyway, he elevated me right away to senior officer of the deck. And so for the next 4 or 5 days, when we were underway doing other things, bombarding and so forth and so covering landing. It was just the captain and me on the bridge. The new captain had had not too much experience on his own. He was an older man, of course. It was really something. At one point, we were to get into a column movement with, I think, 8 ships in the column, and we were to be number 8 or something like that. And it was time for us to make the move to get where we were supposed to be getting. And I said to the captain, isn't it time that we're making the move to the helm? Because on a battleship, you have to gauge when you make a move to turn at the position of the wake in front of you. So, that, you know, I mean, it's just kind of difficult to explain. But anyway, he just said, it's your call. And he was just testing me. Anyway, I breathed a little prayer, I guess, and made the call to the helmsman. I thought it'd make it, and turned out perfectly where we were supposed to be. It was a miracle, really. I mean, kind of fortunate that we ended up where we did.
Because if you don't get that timing right, you could collide with another ship.
You could be,
Or mess up a big domino effect.
Right.
So you're 23 years old and you're making those kind of calls. But I want to take you back to those moments, because you have some papers here from the National Archives. These are the official records of the ship of that day. And every single one of those descriptions is signed by G.A. Erickson. That's you. And you told us about what happened to the captain. He's killed by the concussion of this explosion, blown back against the bulkhead.
Yep.
The other sailor who's right there next to him, who he's trying to console or tell him, stay where you are. And I'm sure some people are listening and say, well, what about you? What happened to you? You're in the same room. It's the same explosion.
Yep.
How are you just fine and right here? What happened there?
I had just a little trickle of blood from top of my ear. A piece of Kleenex took care of it. You know what I mean? I just wasn't injured.
But how far are you from the captain?
About 6 feet.
You're 6 feet away.
About 6 feet.
Yeah. He's killed.
Yeah.
You're okay.
Just, you know, one of those things.
How do you explain that? I mean, I don't want to make too much of it, but it almost sounds like it's a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego or Daniel in the lion's den going on here. How in the world does it work that way?
Well, I don't know. It's just one of those things. I was blessed. I guess I had other fish to fry, you know.
Because that explosion clearly could have knocked you off your feet, too, if it knocked the captain off his feet.
Yeah.
Just the angle of the blast or something?
Probably.
Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I've thought about it a few times,
It is pretty remarkable, don't you think?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And then all of a sudden you have all this responsibility. You know, maybe this would be interesting for people and educational for them too. There was something that happened on the ship not long after that where you guys honored those who died that day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Can you paint a picture of that for us? What's that like? What it looks like, and maybe more importantly, what it feels like to be a part of that?
We had a regular memorial service later, but that night, about midnight, it was a very moving experience. All the those killed were flag-draped and then buried at sea. That was really quite an experience. We had a chaplain aboard ship who participated in that. I don't know, it was just a very touching experience. I mean, it's one of those things that happened. And
that includes that captain who was 6 feet away from you. His
his
coffin is draped with the flag and
pushed
out into the sea.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
And as you're watching that happen, in my mind, that's where it would sink in. Why isn't that, why am I not in one of those coffins?
Yeah. Well, it still never, I never have a thought about it.
And I get the sense that that's still, just talking about it right now, kind of takes you back to that moment. You feel those same emotions?
I do. I've always said in my total experience in life, growing up and so forth, there was a bit of scripture that always came to me. The Apostle Paul said, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. I have thought about that many times, you know, in the service and at other times, even since.
Philippians 4:13. Yep.
Yeah.
And I guess the implication there is you never know what you're going to face.
No, that's true.
But if you have that as your baseline or your foundation, that whatever it is, you'll get through it.
Right.
And you did get through it.
Yeah.
And there were some more. I'm looking here at a story you tell about 2 torpedo wakes, and somehow you're bracketed in by both of them, but they both missed you?
Yes. Well, actually, when we left the Philippines going east, we were going through Surigao Straits. The Indianapolis cruiser was behind us, immediately behind us, probably 1,000 yards, something like that. The lookouts sighted a torpedo wake on the right, and the captain, Captain Warren, was standing on the starboard side of the ship from the bridge, took note of that, and so he started giving order to the helmsman to dodge this torpedo. And I was on the left wing looking out and thought, there's a torpedo wake coming in from the left side. So I started to give an order to the helmsman. The helmsman about went crazy because he didn't know whose order he was supposed to take, you know.
Yeah.
And so I remember Captain Warren say, you take every order you're given, just like that, you know. I could hear him say that. After this was all over, the captain came in and he said, you know, that was so close, I could have hit it with a spud. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, didn't you see that? And and I said, no, I was on the other side, dodging a torpedo coming in from the other side. And he was sort of flabbergasted. And the Indianapolis took a picture of that.
The picture shows your ship, the New Mexico.
Yes.
With a torpedo wake on each side of it.
Yes, right.
So the whole time the captain's saying, turn this way to get out of the way of this one.
Yes.
You're on the other side saying, no, turn this way to get out of the way of that.
Yeah, it was a sort of a zigzag kind of a thing,
And somehow miraculously?
Miraculously, yeah.
They both miss you.
Yeah.
With each story, it seems like you're beating even more odds.
In a battleship, you have a lot more steel, you know, than if you were a cruiser or a destroyer. It would have done a lot more damage.
Mm-hmm.
Not as much to a battleship, maybe, as it would be like to a cruiser.
But it would have done enough.
It would have done enough,
and then you would see enough after that. And you mentioned the Indianapolis. Of course, it famously was sunk by Japanese torpedoes after delivering the elements of the atomic bomb to Tinian. And that's where all the shark attacks came in. We've heard from survivors of that ship on this program. But we're talking to someone from the USS New Mexico, Grant Erickson. And you haven't even gotten to Okinawa yet. And that's where it got crazy.
Really crazy.
And that's where we'll pick things up when we come back. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million and EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Grant Erickson of Santa Cruz, California, a retired educator who's been educating us about his World War II battleship, the USS New Mexico. You'll find photos of Grant then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off, he referred to the kamikaze threat off of Okinawa as getting really crazy. How long did it go on like that?
Weeks. Weeks and weeks of...
Just nonstop kamikazes?
Almost, yeah.
How do you face that?
Gets kind of repetitious after a while. You know, we had an interesting happening there in Okinawa. The Indianapolis, about 3 weeks, I guess it was, before we were hit, a second time with a suicide plane, was hit by a suicide plane, and it did a lot of damage. And about 4 days after it was hit, Admiral Spruance, who was aboard the Indianapolis, came aboard our ship with some of his flag yeomen and so forth. So they were aboard our ship. At one time, the LSGs were making smoke screen to envelop all of us in smoke because there were a lot of suicide planes, and also we heard there were suicide boats also doing damage. So they were making smoke. Our call name was Ironsides. I can remember the captain, since we weren't enveloped in smoke, wondering why we weren't, you know. He wanted to protect the Admiral and everybody else. So he sent his gunnery officer in a motor whaleboat off to try to get to the ship that was doing this smoke screening. And shortly after the whaleboat left the ship, the smoke just poured in. And actually, the whaleboat kind of got lost.
I bet.
And it couldn't figure out how to get back. And I remember we had to ring the ship's bell several times to give the identification for where we were, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they got back all right.
Do you mention the Indianapolis getting hit? So all these guys are evacuated onto your ship.
And yes.
Maybe it saved some of their lives with what happened to the Indianapolis.
Because yes.
I believe, if I remember correctly, there's about 800 of the 1,100 on board died when it sunk. But
right.
Then your ship gets hit again by kamikazes.
Right.
On the 12th of May, and you've got a photo of this that I'll put at hometownheroesradio.com of the explosion.
Yes.
On your ship.
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
Well, that was another big blast. I was at my battle station, which was on the navigation bridge. I could see the plane coming. It was coming toward the starboard side of the ship, straight, low over the water. It was a twin engine. It had also been hit, but it came right in and hit the 20-millimeter and 40-millimeter guns mouth in that area on topside. It just practically wiped out our Marine detachment. Every battleship has a complement of about 75 Marines who handle those duties, the 20 and 40-millimeter guns mostly. We had about that time maybe 55 killed, something like that. The plane itself landed down in the bottom of one of our stacks with the pilot minus his head. Anyway, it created actually more damage that time than the time we were hit in Kwajalein, because it did a lot of damage down below, you know.
Well, and the bomb went off, and then that sets off gasoline.
Yeah.
And you describe it here like a giant blowtorch.
Right.
You just see flame, flame shooting up into the sky.
Right, right.
And those who were killed, you mentioned 55 killed.
Yeah, right.
All those Marines on those guns, I mean, the purpose of those guns is to shoot down airplanes.
Right.
So they're probably firing at this bomber the whole time until it hits them and kills them.
Right.
That's the ugliness of war.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Did you ever get numb to that? The loss of life, the devastation, the chaos?
I guess I just took it as another day's work, you know. It just
When those things happened, did you think back about that wife who was waiting for you back home?
Yeah, I think about that once in a while.
And you said you never doubted that you were going to come back and see her again, even in the midst of circumstances like that.
Yeah.
You were given the Bronze Star during your time aboard the New Mexico.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that for?
Well, I guess it was the way it says, meritorious service. And then a few, you know, a few other things, I guess.
Mm-hmm. They thought you did all right.
I guess
so. As a 90-day wonder.
I guess so.
What was it like when you found out the Japanese were surrendering? And your ship actually escorted the Missouri into Tokyo Bay?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
The surrender documents were signed on the Missouri?
Yeah.
What did it mean to you when the war ended? When, I mean, you've been at this quite a while. You've been through some significant situations. To know that it was all over and your side had won, what was that like for you?
It was certainly a feeling of relief. There had been something thinking about the war. You know, I came from Delray, California, on a farm, and many of my school buddies and friends were Japanese. You know, I knew that they had been taken to concentration camps and so forth in Arizona and so forth. That part of it was kind of troubling to me. But war is war, and I guess you do what you have to do. But I was happy that that part of it was over. And the war ended, you know. It's kind of unlike war today. In the Mideast, it never seems to end, you know.
Right.
It goes on and on. It's a different kind of a situation. But I was happy that it was over. And post-war, as it turned out, I went into teaching and ultimately became principal of Kingsmere High School. And my very fond secretary was the Japanese Lily Katayama, and she had been there for a number of years, and she was just the best. Mm-hmm. And eventually, my bookkeeper was also Japanese, Louise Kanatsu. Just wonderful people, and there was no animosity or anything like that. You know, it just seemed like nice that everything was over.
I want to ask you a little more about your family. Now, today and back then, when we talk about a Gold Star mother, we're usually talking about a mother who's had to deal with the loss of her child, that her child was killed in the service of our country. But your mother was made an honorary Gold Star mother just by sheer volume. Huh? In Delray, the Legion Post?
Legion Post, yes.
They gave her a Gold Star.
Yeah.
Because there were five of you. She had five sons out there. Yeah. And that is no small sacrifice.
She was just a very wonderful person. And because most of my brothers were on the farm and so forth and so on, I was my mother's helper in the kitchen. Much of the time, she taught me all I know about cooking. Mm-hmm. She was a great cook. She wrote letters all the time, all five of us. She had a lot of letter writing to do.
I guess so.
And but it was always great to get letters from home.
And you write here about one letter you got from your dad, the only one you ever got from your dad while you're overseas.
Yeah.
I get the sense that that meant quite a bit to you.
Well, it really did, because I think being the 10th born in a family of 11, we were never that close.
Sure.
I always kind of had the feeling that I could never quite satisfy my dad, you know, although he was always there when he needed to be there, you know, and I knew that he loved me, but that was quite a letter.
I don't know if this is asking my much, too much, but you think you could try to read it for us?
Oh, I probably could. Would you like me to read it? Okay. I wish I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight. As I sit watching that small star and wondering how and where you are. You know, son, it's a funny thing how close a war can always bring a family who for years with pride have kept emotion deep inside. I'm sorry that when you were small I let reserve build up that wall. I told you real men never cried. And it was moms who always dried your tears and smoothed the hurt away so you couldn't go back to play. But son, deep down within my heart, I long to have some little part in drying that small tear-stained face. But we were men. Men don't embrace. Now suddenly I find my son a full-grown man with childhood done. Tonight you're far across the sea and waging war for men like me. Well, somehow pride and what is right just do not seem to go tonight. I find my eyes won't stay quite dry. I find that sometimes men do cry. And if we stood here face to face, I fear we'd find men do embrace. Son, dads are quite a funny lot. And if I've failed you in some spot, it's not because I love you less. It's just that thing called manliness. But if I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight, the words would ring out loud and true. I'm proud, my boy, so proud of you. I got through it.
You did. Where were you when you got that letter?
That was after our ship was hit, actually, in January. Sometime between that time and the time we were in Okinawa, they hit the second time.
And your father is expressing things there that he had never expressed before, and he's sharing with you that his eyes aren't dry. I bet yours weren't either when you read it.
They weren't, really. Yeah, I'm not the crying type, but yeah, the tears came, yeah.
Especially on that last line, I bet.
Yeah.
I'm proud, my boy, so proud of you.
Yeah.
Powerful. What are you most proud of today? I mean, you're 94 years old. This is ancient history, what you did in World War II. But it is pretty remarkable that you survived everything you've told us about today.
Well, I had a wonderful marriage. My wife died on Christmas Eve in 2007 after 63 years of marriage. I'm proud of three wonderful kids. They're not kids anymore. They're 63, 66, and 68. But anyway, and then I have, among them, I have a granddaughter who graduated from Yale Law School in May last year, and a pastor state bar, and is in work for Richard Paez, the judge of the Ninth Circuit Court down in Pasadena. Proud of the family.
When you look back, and you've revisited a lot of it today, what's the most remarkable part in your mind of your journey through World War II, the things that you went through, the things that you survived, the things that you witnessed? What stands out for you the most?
Well, I think it would have to be the association with all of the men and the officers with whom I served. They were just a great bunch of people. These were trying times, but everyone seemed to do their part, you know, well. And I think it was the camaraderie that kept things going.
Most people listening to this weren't alive when this was all going on. I mean, they don't know what it was like to hear the news of Pearl Harbor or to be in the Pacific with the kamikazes everywhere, to see a nation unite the way America did behind 16 million in uniform. What do you think is most important for us today who didn't live through this? What do we need to know and remember about that time in our nation's history and what you and your brothers and all these other Americans did?
In view of the circumstances in which we found ourselves, for example, when the world got into this terrible conflict, and then in particular when Pearl Harbor was hit as it was, we had to rise to the occasion and protect our country and go to bat for her. I think that the fact that we did that, something we had to do. We had to go to work and try to bring a peaceful settlement. And, of course, that's what we have to think about even today. It's very troubling, the times in which we live.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you think we need to know?
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity. It's been pleasant.
Well, good.
You've been a pleasure.
Two brothers down. I wish I could have gotten all five of you to tell all your stories, but it's a pretty remarkable family that you come from. And I mean, you're in incredible shape at 94. What's your secret?
I have a positive attitude, and I work. I keep busy, particularly at church. I've been on the ground, building and grounds for 35 years there, helped in that regard.
Here in Santa Cruz?
Yep.
What's the church?
Peace United Church of Christ up on High Street.
Uh-huh.
We have a lot of university people in our church.
Uh-huh.
That's a great church. By the way, one of the other things that I didn't mention in our little talk was, I think it was rather unique that I was able out in the South Pacific to visit with my brother who was on the Washington.
Yeah.
Very briefly. And then with my brother who was an officer in the field artillery in Lady Gulf, who came aboard our ship to visit with me.
How about
visited
that?
My two brothers briefly, of course.
Yeah, but that is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And I bet that meant the world to you at the time.
It did. It did. It was really great.
Thousands of miles from that farm in Delray.
Right.
And you get to meet up two different brothers out there.
That's right.
That is something. I guess one more just out of the blue question that comes to mind. Here you are, an important officer on this huge battleship. What was more challenging for you, carrying out that duty as a 23-year-old, or 20 years later being a high school principal?
Oh, I think the more challenging was managing the high school.
I had a feeling you might say that.
But I did enjoy that.
Well, we sure have enjoyed this hour with Grant Erickson. Don't forget to look through his photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com, where his podcast has a few stories that didn't quite fit into our radio time today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.